I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The Omicron variant is just the latest challenge faced by healthcare providers. While much is still not known about this new variant, what is known is that for nearly 2 years, COVID-19 has stressed healthcare workers in an unprecedented way. Today on Midday, how one of the world's major players in healthcare is responding to the myriad challenges caused by COVID-19. My guest is Kevin Sowers, the president of the Johns Hopkins Health System and executive vice president of Johns Hopkins Medicine. Plus, Sonia Sohn starred in HBO's The Wire as a Baltimore police detective, and now she's made a film that will air on HBO next week about the controversy surrounding the death of a real Baltimore police detective, Sean Souter. Sonia Sohn joins me to talk about the slow hustle. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. A grim reminder that the COVID crisis is not yet a thing of the past came last week when health officials in South Africa were the first to announce the appearance of a new variant, Omicron, which has since been identified in more than 15 countries. CBS News is reporting today that the new variant appeared in Europe at least a week before it was detected in Southern Africa. It is only a matter of time before it's detected in the United States. The World Health Organization has warned that the new variant poses a very high risk globally, but questions about how transmissible it is, how virulent it may be, and if our current regimen of vaccines provide enough protection remain unanswered. Yesterday, President Biden said that the Omicron variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. The U.S. and many other nations have banned travel from South Africa and seven other countries in Southern Africa, a decision that has been met with derision in the affected countries. This new development is just the latest challenge facing healthcare providers across the country. My first guest today is Kevin Sowers, who is the president of the Johns Hopkins Health System and executive vice president of Johns Hopkins Medicine. In that capacity, he oversees six hospitals and Johns Hopkins Community Physicians, which has more than 40 outpatient sites throughout Maryland and Washington, D.C. Full disclosure, my wife, Linnelle Smith, works in the Marketing and Communications Department at Johns Hopkins Medicine, and Kevin Sowers joins us on the phone from his office in Baltimore. Mr. Sowers, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Tom, thank you so much for allowing me to be with you today.
So when news like this new variant, the Omicron variant, comes to Hopkins, what happens at Hopkins? Is there a particular protocol that you undertake knowing that, there's a possibility that we're going to have renewed problems?
So since the beginning of the pandemic, we have actually had a unified command center, which is made up of senior leadership and a lot of our clinical experts that meet throughout the week and sometimes three times a week and goes through the key issues, the planning issues. And so we began meeting the minute we heard about the Omicron virus to begin to think about what we might need to do to be prepared, from everything from supplies and materials to understanding have we seen the variant yet in the Maryland area, because we just celebrated doing our 1 millionth test in terms of being able to look at the types of variants that we're seeing and mutations that we're seeing in the Baltimore and surrounding regions. And so clearly we began a whole series of planning exercises, even as we think about the potential for another surge in our hospitals and how we would respond to that. So we're always trying to be ahead of the curve and understanding how best to support our communities.
Even before Omicron has been detected here in Maryland, or at this hour, nowhere in the United States yet, here in Maryland, we're up 1,244 cases of coronavirus since yesterday. There are currently 663 people hospitalized. That's the highest level of hospitalizations in more than a month. Our positivity rate has peaked above 5% for the first time since the end of August, I believe. We're at 5.04% positivity rate. Are you concerned about space in the ICUs and space in the COVID wards and, you know, stress on the on your hospitals?
You know, Tom, I think we have to look at this at a macro level in the country, and then we have to get down to what it means for citizens in Maryland. If you look at hot spots like Colorado, for instance, or if you look currently in Boston, those are individual places where their positivity rates have shot up. The issue we've got to face is not to overwhelm the healthcare system. If we go back to what happened during our first surge over 22 months ago, and we canceled elective surgeries across the country, we saw people with strokes and heart attacks in our emergency rooms decline by 30%. We saw a lot more people dying in the field from that. So there was unintended consequences of that surge. One of the things that's different about this surge is our labor workforce shortage issues. While all industries across the nation have been impacted, and we've seen the statistics of where in August 4.6 million people quit their jobs, that has also impacted healthcare, and not just nursing or not just our physicians, but every level of the team has been impacted that. So one of the things that would be more overwhelming for yet another surge is our abilities to really take care of non-COVID and COVID patients at the same time. And we'd have to make decisions about how we'd manage elective procedures and surgeries during that time. And so that's one of the things that I think we have to think about as we approach this these winter months, when we do have risks with people coming indoors for yet another surge, is the impact of overwhelming the health system.
Kevin Sowers is my guest. He's the president of the Johns Hopkins Health System and executive vice president of Johns Hopkins Medicine. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. And Mr. Sowers, I was looking at an article about the shortage of nurses. This comes from a journal published by Johns Hopkins Nursing. And the first line of this piece says that the nursing shortage is a global shortage. And this is an article that came out in 2010. So this is not a new problem, but it is certainly, as you've just alluded to, been exacerbated by the coronavirus and by a number of other factors. How is it affecting Hopkins? What's your level of staffing when it comes to nurses and physicians and other medical personnel? And how are you moving forward planning to address this, you know, clear challenge that you and others in your field are facing?
Yeah, you know, Tom, it's an important question, and I began my career as a nurse, so I take the nursing impact very seriously. As I think about what's happened during this time, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, nurses were critical at the bedside in caring for COVID patients because, you know, a lot of the patients that were very ill and dying were not with their family members, and that's not the model of care that we're accustomed to. We have always been taught to have the patient and family at the center of everything we do, and the patient was at the center, but we had to look for new ways to engage family members in their loved ones' care through you know, iPads and iPhones and a variety of different ways. But not having someone at the bedside from the family at the time of death, I think, created a lot of moral distress, not just for our nurses, but also for our physician providers. And so when I look back on the impact of that, and resilience and well-being was an issue for our workforce, all providers, prior to the pandemic, but the pandemic has even made it more difficult. And so we've put a lot of strategies in place to focus on supporting our workforce and supporting our employees who may be having issues and struggles with that. But some people have chosen to leave healthcare. The other impact is schools closed. We saw a lot of our female employees leave the workforce. They had to make decisions around how to balance whether they were going to stay at home with their kids and deal with the at-home schooling issues. We also saw individuals who their loved ones had lost jobs at home from other parts of the sector, but also saw the economic impact of needing to make decisions about how to sustain their own lives. And so people have had to make a lot of difficult choices during this time. The current strategy that we're working on is really coming up with, number one, new care delivery models that would still have nursing as a key role in practicing at the top of their license, but clearly beginning to consider how we would add other types of positions. The challenge we have, though, is, and I can't reinforce this enough, it's not just a nursing workforce shortage issue. We have an issue of hiring entry-level positions for patient transporters that take patients to radiologies and a variety of other places, phlebotomists, patient care techs. So it's really, it's more than just nursing. And the reason that's important for our folks to understand is because it impacts the entire team's ability to deliver in the care model and actually puts more pressure on the nurse to fulfill those roles that we're having difficulty filling within the team. So we've put strategies around retention and recruitment. We've put, just as the rest of the country is faced with challenges of escalating requirements for pay and for benefits, we are approaching that also. So there's a series of things that we have done to try to recruit and retain our workforce moving forward.
Is it just a matter of money? I mean, are you able to say, okay, clearly the market is going to demand that we pay people at all of these levels simply more than we've been paying? I mean, it's not all that long. It's been, I think, less than a year since the minimum wage at Johns Hopkins for the lowest employees went to $15 an hour. There's $100 million of federal funds that have evidently been allocated for nurses in particular. There is a huge discrepancy between what travel nurses are making and what the permanent nurses who are already employed by the hospital are making. There's some reports that say that travel nurses are billing more than $150 an hour for their services. And as of 2017, the last time, or the most recent data I could gather, the average wage for a nurse in Maryland was just below $36 an hour. How do you handle that tension when you've got, you know, potentially a person making $150 an hour and a person making $36 an hour working side by side?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Tom. You have to balance the needs of the community with what the workforce demands are. You know, when you hear the agency rates, the agency rates are right now somewhere between $180 and $210 an hour. The nurse is not taking that amount home. So those are agency rates. I am concerned about the sustainability of this in the market, and we've engaged with the American Hospital Association and a variety of folks because the price gouging during this time is concerning about what we're seeing from agencies. We're watching people who are 1 to 5 years out of school really go with agencies because of not seeing themselves in need of the benefit structures that we have in place. But and so that's important discussion is the difference between total comp versus just base pay. And so we are seeing a part of our workforce that is chasing the dollar through the agency mechanism. But we've watched this bubble before, and it's not sustainable from just a pure economic standpoint. One of the things that makes healthcare different is when we compare ourselves to other industries. Yes, other industries may be saying we are increasing our base pay beyond 15, and we're going to 18 to 19. They're able to pass that down to the consumer. In healthcare, we're not able to do that. We're not able to pass that and go back to the payers or in Maryland and all payer state and say we're going to pass that down to the consumers. So that forces us to take other actions in terms of making sure that we have fiscal stability as an organization to continue to serve our folks moving forward in our communities. So I would say to you that it is concerning what I'm seeing in terms of the marketplace. I don't think at the end of the day it's only about money. I have been a nurse for over 36 years now and also been in healthcare that long. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's also the culture of the organization and the relationships you have with the people that you work with and the relationships you have with your managers that make an incredible difference of your ability to want to stay in an organization. So money is one part, and we're addressing that, but I think there are other elements that keep people connected to the purpose of why we went into healthcare.
If you've just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Kevin Sowers. He's the president of the Johns Hopkins Health System and the executive vice president of Johns Hopkins Medicine. And Mr. Sowers, how about compliance with vaccine mandates, which have been mandated across the board for all people in the healthcare field? Is that a contributing factor to the difficulty that you're experiencing attracting people to jobs at various levels in the system? What is the rate of compliance so far at Hopkins, and how do you see that factor, informing our understanding of what's going on?
Yeah, Tom, you may know that we made this as a condition of employment a while back, and I'm very proud of our workforce. Out of 45,000 employees, only 99 people chose not to be vaccinated. So we clearly have a vaccinated workforce. It did take a lot of effort and educating people about the science of the vaccine, but clearly I can tell you that it was an important part because we felt like if we were committed to protecting our community and protecting the people that we served, that our workforce be vaccinated. And then soon after we announced that, CMS and the federal government did come out and mandate that, along with our governor, that all healthcare workers were required to be vaccinated. But I'm really proud of our workforce and what they've done. If you look at the number of people who chose not to be vaccinated, so that has not been a limiting factor. The second thing around recruitment and retention is because it's now a national requirement for people to be vaccinated. It's not been a limiting factor because if you want to stay in healthcare, you're going to have to be vaccinated no matter where you go. So that we've not seen that as a limiting factor at this time.
What about telehealth? Regulations regarding telehealth were relaxed at the beginning of the pandemic so that physicians could treat people online in those circumstances in which it was appropriate. Now some of those restrictions are back in place. How do you see the future of being able to, you know, get a consult from a physician on a video chat or a phone call changing and evolving moving forward? And do you think that's an important development?
Telehealth has to be a part of our future. You know, the pandemic pushed us very quickly into that element. But I would say Dr. Rothman, who's the dean of the School of Medicine, and I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post encouraging our lawmakers to deal with two issues. And that's the issue of cross state lines, credentialing, and also licensure. Because during the crisis, that was lifted, those requirements. Now those requirements are back in place, which makes it more difficult for us to provide telemedicine across state lines. And so that is going to have to be dealt with as we move forward. We went overnight from a couple hundred telemedicine visits to over 6,000 a day. And so clearly telemedicine became a very important part of our keeping our connection with our patients and our follow-up with our patients. And so I would say that from a policy-making perspective, we're going to have to address those issues, because I think it's a cost-effective way and also allows us to have access to our patients in a more timely way and them to us. So I think it's a critical part of our future.
We are still, as a country and as a planet, grappling with the fact that there are a number of people who simply do not choose to be vaccinated. Given your experience over these last 22 months, what do you think a strategy to encourage those people who are still on the fence, who still haven't gotten the jab, to get the jab? I mean, the United States is still under 70% people fully vaccinated. And that's just so disappointing to so many people. And it, by all measures, seems to contribute to these variants that are allowed to, the mutations that are allowed to happen because there are so many unvaccinated people. What do you think we should be doing and can be doing moving forward?
So I think it takes a village. And what I mean by that is, yes, there are people who do not want to be vaccinated because of their belief system. And so I'll set that segment of the population aside. There is another part of the population that I will call vulnerable parts of our population that just can't get to access. And so we've partnered with the state, the city. We've done this in D.C. also. And we reached out to vulnerable populations in nursing homes, in senior housing units, where we actually took tactical teams in and provided vaccines on site. And these are folks who have mobility issues, who have transportation issues, and so they want the vaccine, but they just didn't have access. So in that sense, I would say that you've got to do more community outreach, and it reminds me of my years I spent in community health as a nurse. And then also, if you look at the Latinx population that we took care of in Baltimore City, from a zip code perspective, it had one of the highest positivity rates in the city, about 30%. We partnered with the church. We partnered with Build in the city, and we actually went to that zip code. And those partnerships were incredibly important to develop the level of trust around testing, but also around vaccination. And that has been a successful part of our enterprise. And so when I say it takes a village for that segment that is a vulnerable population, I use those examples because I think it's going to take more of that to reach those parts of our community. But I would also say for the folks who have a different belief system around vaccinations, it's important to keep the conversations grounded in the science. And that's one of the things that Hopkins early on, and you may know, our website became globally known because we wanted to not allow other factors to play into the discussion, but we wanted it to be a fact-based, science-based discussion around what was actually taking place in our communities and our world around the virus and the vaccination. And so we continue to play that role as much as we can, but at times that takes a lot of hand-holding and a lot of ongoing dialogue in leading that discussion. I will say, though, that as I look at hospitalizations today, vaccination versus unvaccination is a key driver as to who's going to be hospitalized. The only important other factor that I would share with the audience today is the importance of getting your booster if you've been vaccinated, because more and more we're seeing data that shows us that over time the antibodies start to wane and your ability to get infected and get sick is even greater. And so the value and the importance of getting that booster is incredibly important right now, especially with the new mutation that we've just learned about.
Absolutely. That is good, solid advice. And you're absolutely right about the website at Hopkins. It remains the go-to source, the gold standard for information about coronavirus worldwide. And we are grateful to that and grateful to you for being with us. Kevin Sowers, the president of Johns Hopkins Health System and executive vice president of Johns Hopkins Medicine. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Coming up, the actor and filmmaker Sonia Sohn will join me. She's made a new film about the 2017 death of Baltimore police detective Sean Souter. Some think Detective Souter committed suicide. Others think that he was murdered. I'll talk to Sonia Sohn about her movie and what she discovered about the case on the other side of a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.